From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who build them.
When you're young, you have no responsibilities in terms of family to take care of. Why not go for it? You know, why not take up this random job working in a startup somewhere that's probably not going to work out?
I'm Connor Carney, and that's the voice of Jack Pierce, CFO and co-founder of Wayflyer, a revenue-based financing service for e-commerce companies. They lend money to businesses to spend on online marketing. Unlike a bank, who would assess a loan application based on standard accounting and cash flow reporting, Wayflyer seamlessly plug into their customers' Google, Facebook, or Instagram platforms and lend money based on the performance of their advertising campaigns. In this conversation, Jack talks about raising $9 million of venture capital, the importance of thinking big, and how playing golf at a high level has prepared him for scaling a venture-backed startup. Jack started our chat by explaining what Wayflyer is and how their service works.
So we do two things at Wayflyer. We do marketing analytics for businesses, and we provide them with capital so they can grow. And really the idea here is, if we can help you figure out how to spend your money more efficiently, you're going to perform better over the long term. You're going to be a better borrower for us. We're probably going to have a better relationship because we're helping you all the time. And hopefully you'll end up taking more money from us and we'll be more profitable off the back of that. So how it works is, a company will come to us and they will connect in their platforms or their different data sources. When I talk about data sources, there's really three types. There's transactional data, which typically comes from payment processors. That's telling me, like, how much did someone buy a product for? What product did they buy? And who is that customer ultimately? We're going to pull out ad platform data, which is going to give us the costs of all the ad campaigns you're running, all the different types of campaigns you're running, and also the amount of people that have basically bought off each campaign, or converted, as we call it, off each campaign.
So Facebook, Google,
Pinterest, TikTok, although that's only getting there at the moment. We also pull in web analytics data, and that kind of allows us to join the end data, the payment data, to the cost data that comes out of the ad platforms. Mm-hmm. What that allows us to do is see every product the company's ever sold, every customer that's come in, where they've come from. Have they come through a Facebook ad? Have they come through a Google ad? Have they come direct to the website? And also if that customer has come back over time. And that means we can get a view of, how much does this company make off each of its customers? Over what time period? Are the customers coming back monthly? Are they coming back 6 monthly? Are they not coming back at all? How much are they spending? And how much through these platforms is it costing the company to get that customer? And ultimately, our judgment every time is, let's make sure that these companies, one, are profitable on each of their customers, because if they are, they've got a pretty good business. But hopefully they can continue to be profitable on their customers as they grow that customer base, as it gets bigger. And to be perfectly honest with you, most of the businesses we work with, being online, it all comes down to, can you acquire a customer and continue to cross-sell to them? Maybe sell other products to them, have a subscription that they're coming back to buy. If you've got that in your business, you've got a really good business there that probably can scale and be quite profitable. One of the biggest problems we see is businesses with maybe one product that don't have an ability to acquire a customer, but don't have an ability to make more money off them long-term. Mm-hmm. And that means you're going to hit a threshold where you just can't get any more customers. It just gets too expensive to get more customers. Yeah, so I think this all came out of, we were always doing the marketing analytics side of it. And we started to realize, a lot of the time we know more about these businesses than they know themselves. And probably one of the most common things we see is, we had a business come to us last week and they've got like a 25x return on their ad spend, which means for every dollar they spend, they're making $25 in sales. And these businesses are like high margin businesses. They're like 60% plus margins. And anyone who's got a return on ad spend that high is not taking advantage of, they don't know how good they are. And really all they need is us to say to them, you're doing a really good job here. Stop spending only $5,000 a week and spend $10,000 a week, and let's see what happens to that return on ad spend. And what we see with a lot of businesses, we've a a business we started with 8 weeks ago, and we started by giving them 40,000, and we're doing 15,000 in sales a week, and they sell kind of gym equipment in the US, and they did 350,000 last week. We haven't optimized anything for them. They have unbelievable creative. They are really good. They have a good marketing team, and just giving them the confidence to spend more was just the secret to it, like, to be perfectly honest with you.
So you identify a good business to lend to. You then fund their expansion based on the metrics that you see, tell them where to spend the money, and fingers crossed.
Exactly. And I think it comes back to, lenders in the past have always pulled out transaction data. So they'll pull out payment processor data and they'll see, okay, this company is consistently getting 15,000 worth of sales. They've no idea if it's marketing generating that sales. Is it a TV show they have? Is it some guy going on the weather forecast with their umbrella? You know, it's really understanding, one, what's driving that. Two, are they doing it profitably? Because you can do it unprofitably, no problem. You'll eventually run out of cash, but you can do it that way. And that's really what we're digging into. And we just want to work with businesses that have an ability to scale profitably. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're looking for.
And how is it different from getting a loan from a bank for an e-commerce company?
Sure. So I think we consider ourselves a fintech company. What does that mean? It probably means we're faster. So typically, if you go into a bank as an e-commerce company, you're going to need to give them, they're going to ask you for like a profit and loss and a balance sheet and some accounts. And these businesses that we work with, they're like a founder and maybe a team of three work online. They pile in and do everything. Probably not going to have that information. It's probably not going to be all that useful. And what we're trying to do is speed up that process. So apart from the bank not really liking lending to e-commerce companies because they don't have any assets, they tend not to have a whole lot of cash on the balance sheet, but they tend to be quite profitable, to be honest with you. We're able to just connect into their data sources. They're able to come to our website. They basically Gmail sign in to allow us to pull down through the APIs the data. And within an hour, they'll have offers. We'll give them about 15 different funding offers. If they accept it, we'll fund them within 24 hours. So it's really a speed thing. Just understanding their business, making it easy through the application process where they don't have to spend more than 5 minutes on it, really. That's kind of the key for us, I'd say.
But it is the way business is probably moving to. It's more data-driven. People are online. All the marketing channels are online. You can see where everything is coming from and where that traffic is coming from, but a bank probably doesn't look at any of that.
Yeah, I think it comes back to, again, the fact that our team is all engineers and data scientists, and they're spending every day building new connectors into new ad platforms that people might be using or into new payment processors that someone might be using. All of these platforms, your Facebooks and your Googles, have been very good to build these lovely APIs that you're able to pull all of the data down through. And banks don't have that ability, or they don't have an engineering team to turn around and actually touch those APIs and pull down through them. And that's probably where the difference is. I'd like to think we're a software company masquerading as a kind of e-commerce bank. Yeah, and the way I think about that is, if your team's probably made up of engineers and data scientists and data analysts and probably got 5x the number of engineers than we do salespeople, that's probably a good place to be in. A guy recently wrote an article called Embedded Lending, and really what he talks about there is all of these new companies that are cropping up where they embed themselves as a software that's helping a business, and actually off the back of that, they'll provide you with capital for whatever that is. So we like to think of ourselves as a software business that's helping you from an analytics perspective, helping you to optimize campaigns, stop spending on bad campaigns, spend more on good campaigns, really putting it simply like that. And off the back of that, if you have a good campaign, we're here with money that we can give you to double down into that. And it's that idea that we're embedded in your company from an analytics perspective, but if we know something's working, why wouldn't we give you the money to kind of grow?
How did you get started in the business?
Let me go back. This probably started back in February 2019. I had met Aidan, his CEO, and he was working in his second startup called Conjura. And they do a lot of their marketing analytics business. They do a lot of diligence for private equity firms in the UK. I was working with VC fund at that time. And we were looking at using, because we were in hardware and we always worked with products, and that's, they tended to have some form of e-commerce element to their business. I wanted to get the guys to help us bring a little bit of data into a world that typically has no data. And I think anyone in venture will tell you that early stage investing is close your eyes and cross your fingers and let's hope it goes well, to a certain extent. And we just wanted to bring in some data to understand, okay, what has happened as this company has gone from spending 2K a week to 5K a week in marketing? Has that customer acquisition cost gone way up, or has it stayed relatively flat? Are any of the customers returning products? Are the customers coming back? And that just gave us a kind of high level insight into maybe the unit economics of those businesses. And I'd seen what a couple of lending businesses were doing in the US on a kind of manual basis. And the idea was, let's take what you're doing in Conjura. We have all of the data on all these businesses, so why would we not do the same thing? Why would we not fund companies that are doing well, that we can look at their numbers and say, yes, they're doing well? And actually, the original idea was probably, let's invest in businesses, let's use this debt fund to scale them and grow them after we've invested. We'll make nice returns on the debt fund and we'll make big gains and valuations on the equity side. And out of the debt fund, we'll also lend to other businesses we don't invest in. And we realized that the debt on its own was pretty attractive, and that's really where it came from. Yeah.
What were you doing at the venture capital firm?
I was managing the portfolio. What does that mean? I was meeting companies. You know, it was probably the coolest job I will ever have. I got to meet about 400 companies in 18 months. You're meeting founders who are excited, telling you their best story. Yeah, it's cool. You're meeting every single different type of business. People are always in good form when they're talking to you. It was cool.
How did you end up there?
Out of luck, I suppose, to a certain extent. Met a guy, an Irish guy called Liam Casey. Ended up working with him. He has a business in San Francisco called PCH. And he had an accelerator program out there called Highway One. And my first job was really to manage out that portfolio. There was 106 companies in it, and we had to figure out how were those companies doing, and how had that portfolio actually performed. And that was my first job, to be honest with you. And off the back of that, all of this kind of came. Yeah.
And what did you know? Like, what did you know about finance? How did you? I mean, were you confident that you could do a job like that right off the bat?
No, I didn't have a clue what I was doing, to be perfectly honest with you. I was absolutely winging it. I think the best thing you can do is throw someone into a like sink or swim situation. And I do it all the time with people here. And people are great at adapting and learning on their feet. I think if they're smart, commercial, they'll figure it out. And there's always people. I used to ring loads of people every day going, I have no idea what I'm doing here. Hopefully you've done it before, and can I send you something? Mm-hmm. And you can look at it and tell me, am I doing it entirely wrong, or is am I on the right track?
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a great learning experience, I'd say. Great learning experience.
What about PwC? What did you do there?
Yeah, so PwC, worked there for 3 years, did my accounting exams, like so many do out of college, probably didn't quite know what I wanted to do, and it was all good fathers say accounting is a good solid thing to have on your CV. So went into PwC. It was great. It's like a little bit like university 2.0. You've got like 223-year-olds going into the same place. Mm-hmm. It was great fun. I worked across a little bit in audit. I worked in transaction services in there. It was never for me. I think I've known for a long time that I was never going to be someone for like big company culture. I just don't like rules, and I don't like having to wait to get things signed off. Maybe it's a bit of impatience, or I don't know exactly what it is, but yeah, I couldn't put up with that.
Well, it's a much more careful, meticulous business, isn't it? You know,
it is, and I think you have a role when you're in those organizations, and I kind of like doing a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the best thing, and but it's good at the start of things, I think. Mm-hmm. and it's good in small situations. So out of PwC, I went to New Zealand. So I was born down in New Zealand, went there, worked with, like, I won't call it a startup, but there was 15 people in the company. Straight away, it was like, again, didn't have a clue what I was doing. But I think when you're working in a consulting firm, like, and you get asked all of a sudden to make a bank transfer from a company account, you're like, I don't even know how to do this, you know? And you figure out everything as you go, but you're doing everything. You're doing everything from like picking products that people are selling. And that was an organic supermarket chain. So when I got there, there was two supermarkets, one in Wellington and one just on the outskirts of Wellington. By the time I left, 9 months later, we had seven supermarkets. We'd done like 60 million in sales in the year. We'd had it open the kitchen and packing operation where we'd do our own product through it. We closed the kitchen and packing operation, bought a building, got financing. You were doing everything, like, you know, and that was really cool.
So a huge learning experience going from what was maybe a set path before to then kind of diving in and getting your hands dirty.
100%. That first 6 months, you're winging it again. I think you're always winging it to a certain extent when you come out of stuff, and you realize after maybe like 2 months of winging it that actually you're pretty good at it, that everyone's actually winging it to a certain extent, because there isn't a playbook necessarily for negotiating a lease or whatever it might be. I would recommend to everyone always to kind of try, get out. I've lots of friends who are accountants. I'm all the time trying to convince them to like go work in a small business for a while. Mm-hmm. Try be financial controller or CFO or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And you'll end up doing a bit of sales, and you'll end up picking products, and you'll end up doing some strategy stuff, and you'll do a bit of everything. But it'll be that learning that you'll probably go, this place was run so badly and I definitely can do better. But you're not loud enough or confident enough to say that. And then you go to another place and you're maybe a little bit more confident to make some changes in there. And then by the time you go to your third place, you're better again. And it's kind of just that confidence building. But yeah, I'd recommend everyone goes and does something like that.
Like being an accountant, it's great to have, and it's a great foundation of understanding of how businesses work and how they make money and everything else. But there's really no substitute for working in a small business and getting to understand commercially how it works and to actually have to do the hard things, you know.
Absolutely. I think if it's an accountant or a consultant or whatever it is, what it does teach you is it just teaches you to like analyze situations, build PowerPoints, and probably get your points across in a good way or a structured way, let's call it. And that's the most helpful thing about it. Yeah, that's the most helpful thing about it.
It's great for the start of your career, certainly, to know, you know, even how to properly send emails.
Yes.
or to summarize things that you've talked about with clients and things like that.
Exactly. Like, I don't do the accounts here. You know, I'm an accountant, and the last thing I would be doing is doing the accounts here. If I can hand that off to someone else, then great, you know, but it's really, really helpful to know, and lots of probably good questions come out at the back of that.
And to be able to understand maybe marketing metrics and for what you're doing now, it's very kind of data driven.
It's very much numbers, and I think, I'm not sure if it's everyone who does accounting maybe, but I'm always, maths was always my thing. I did maths, applied maths, physics, that was what I did, gave grinds in college. That was my buzz, let's call it. It's helpful for marketing, for sure. We've got like some incredibly smart people who work for us, and the analysis that they can do on numbers and the insights they can pull out of it is every single time they have a call with it, one of our customers think it's the greatest thing of all time. And It's that ability to go back to numbers and say, am I making money off these campaigns? Like at a very, very high level, that maybe marketing people to a certain extent just are not the right people to look at it that way. It's very black and white. Marketing is not black and white. It's every color of the rainbow. And it's probably performance marketing is this Facebook, Google side of things. And that's just a numbers game. And really it should be an analyst or a numbers person, someone who did maths in Trinity, looking at that and doing that for you and analyzing it for you, managing it for you.
So you ended up in, were you working in San Francisco at the BC firm?
Yeah, so it's between San Fran and here. Build up a lot of air miles. It was great. I was in New York a lot as well. In Cork a bit too, funnily enough.
With a company?
That's where Liam's from. Okay. He's down there.
Yeah.
And Cork people always like investing in other Cork companies. And that's just a thing that they have. And so, yeah, we had a few investments down in Cork. But yeah, it was great. It was really, really good. Definitely the thing I learned most from that was that when you see like, so many businesses doing so many cool things. Like San Francisco is a great city for the people there. I'm not sure I love the city itself, but there's people doing really, really interesting things. And they have this like think big mentality, like think crazy big mentality. Let's take over the world. There's no let's build a business. It's let's build a $50 billion business. Mm-hmm. And when you realize that, when you start thinking that way, it helps. But also when you realize that the people who are kind of starting these businesses and running these businesses actually are, they're not the most intellectual person in the entire world. It's not out of your reach. They're just normal people. Most of the time, they're really good at sales, to be perfectly honest with you. And it gets probably understated to a certain extent. Most of your success in early businesses will come down to sales, because if you can't raise money, then you're not going to get very far. And so it's just that ability to, I always say it now to people, I say, I have so many friends that I go, you're way smarter, way more innovative than a lot of these people I've met. They're very, very successful. And you just need to pull the trigger. Yeah. And it's maybe that risk level. I don't know what the difference is between someone who starts their business and not, but I always think I have friends who, when we go to play poker on a Wednesday night, some friends want to play for €5 and some friends want to play for €100. And the people who play want to play for €100, they're probably the guys who'll start their own business, and the people who want to play for €5, they probably won't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's a perceived risk as well, you know, this idea of Americans in general just thinking far bigger because they've seen maybe closer to home people doing it, you know, and yeah, doing massive things instead of kind of playing small and
it's just exposure to it. Like you've hit the nail on the head. It's just exposure to it. It's just seeing it and realizing that actually, yes, I can do that too. And it's probably, you're more aggressive in everything you do when you start thinking bigger like that. You know, the first thing we did was, our first customer was in the US, you know, because we said, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it in the States, you know, because that's where everything is. And and we're now in Australia, and we're in the UK, we're in the Netherlands, we're here in Ireland, we're going to France and Germany and Spain in the next few weeks. We're looking at Asia. It's like, how big can we get? How far can we spread out? And that thinking big has helped that. If I hadn't gone and had that experience, maybe I'd just be in Ireland and the UK, you know, and we'd never even consider going to the US because why would we do that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it must have had some impact because you said the kind of idea stage for this was February 2019.
Sure.
Now, I mean, it's pretty big here. How many staff do you have now?
Yeah, so we're up to 37 people. So the idea, say, started in February 2019. We really only started doing anything about it in maybe July 2019. And that first part was, can we go get investors to actually give us money for this? Let's start with that point. We went and did that and started the company in September. And so we started with, I think there were six people when we started. back in March, we had 10 people, and now we're at 37 people. So the last few months have been crazy, a lot of fun. It's nice having new people coming into the office every week at this stage. Everyone's pretty close in here, and we have beers on Thursday nights, and everyone gets along very well, and it's fun. I'd say the next year is kind of, lots of people have said to me, enjoy the next year, because it's going to be the most fun when the team is still small and close and growing and everyone's kind of excited about it. Mm-hmm. That's definitely the best time in a business, and so that's my plan.
Talk to me about raising money, you know, thinking big in order to think as big as they do in San Francisco. Sure. You're going to have to raise money.
Sure.
How much did you raise initially, and have you raised more since?
So we have raised $9 million in equity, and then we've got a whole bunch of debt streams that we use to lend to businesses as well. Mm-hmm. It was good. Initially, we went to people we have connections with, flew to the States straight away. Our first investor was a guy out of New York. Our second investor was a guy out of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And that's how we started. That got us enough money to literally get going and try build something. And we've recently raised a larger round. We've done a VC round. We've got a few funds out of the US who've invested.
Do you think it's the concept, like how much does an investor look at the idea versus the people who are claiming that they're the right people to execute it? What are the metrics that they're looking at when they're going to fund you?
They're looking at a range of things. The QED will say that they're looking at the unit economics, and they're looking at the sector. And thankfully, we're in a good sector, I'd say. They're definitely looking at the people and wondering if they can get done. Their biggest question for us when we first start talking to them is, can these guys actually sell and get things going? And what we really needed to prove to them was, yes, we can. So when that question was there, it was, okay, let's go get a whole bunch of customers. Mm-hmm. And then turn around and say, see, we can do it. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the biggest question for it. But they're looking at everything. I think it's case-by-case basis. I don't know, to be perfectly honest with you. Mm-hmm. I got a great piece of advice from my old boss years ago. It was from an investment standpoint. He said that always invest in companies or people that can raise money. Okay? He said, because in this early stage investing, no one ever figures it out the first time. Mm-hmm. Never. And they're going to have they're going to be down in the dumps a few times. They're going to have made a mess of everything. But if they're really good at raising money, they'll be able to go for long enough that they'll figure it out. And I think that I've seen this run true in so many companies. If you can just, and so many people have written about it in different ways. It's like, if you can just stay alive long enough, you end up succeeding. And I think the thing that allows you to stay alive long enough is your ability to raise money. And that's from an investment point of view, that was. But I think that runs back to, mm-hmm. like, it's really, can you sell? You know, because if you can sell, you're going to be good at raising money, but you're also going to get enough customers early that you probably can convince someone that you deserve more money. And so early stage in businesses, it can't be understated how important it is to have that.
In your case, and raising the finance and everything, have you dedicated one person or one resource or kind of more resources towards raising money because of that advice?
It's myself who kind of fronts it, and Aiden does it as well. It's the two of us together. Mm-hmm. I probably start the processes everywhere, and Aiden is unbelievable when you're in a room with 15 different venture guys and they're throwing questions left, right, and center at you. I've never seen anyone dance like he dances in those rooms. He gets around every single question mm-hmm. they could possibly throw at him. Yeah,
which is probably great. What they want to see as well.
It is.
You know the business, can you answer our questions?
It is. Yeah. It's that ability to get asked a question, answer it, mm-hmm. and somehow have given them an answer completely unrelated to what they asked you, and they're happy with it.
What would you say your strengths are in the business?
I think I'm good with ideas for like what should we do mm-hmm. from a strategy point of view. I think I'm pretty good with people, and so raising money is a natural strong point that comes out of that. Mm-hmm. I just have people I've good connections with and good relationships with, and that's helpful. So I'd say that's probably mm-hmm. my strong point in the business. Just building relationships with investors or our first customers. I was doing all of the calls to them. I was doing all the emails to them, and still would do that quite regularly. Yeah. Last night I did 3 sales calls because one of the other guys who was meant to be on them was out. Mm-hmm. So that's cool. It's nice to get back and do all of that.
Do you think it's having a kind of finance accounting background and having the sales, do you think that's a good combination?
Yeah, I think it's definitely helpful having the finance background. I think it helps you to analyze things. I think it helps you to probably focus in on the most important thing to do tomorrow. Because you come back to like revenue or like gross profit, and you're like, what can I do that is going to give me the most revenue? What's mm-hmm. the most important thing I can do now that's going to impact that revenue? And like early doors, that's maybe a short-term view, mm-hmm. but like you need to show progress early to be able to get more money to keep going. And so all you're trying to do the entire time is give yourself capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're just trying to give yourself capacity. If you can get capacity, you can then go and focus on building this unbelievable automated product that's going to solve marketing for every company in the world, mm-hmm. but that's going to take you 5 years, mm-hmm. and you're not going to be able to sell that to anyone early. So let's figure out ways we can make money and grow revenue and show someone progress so I can keep going, hire more people, get to a point that we do have capacity to do things.
What are your weaknesses in the business?
What are my weaknesses? I'm probably not very technical from a software engineering point of view. Mm-hmm. I don't know how a platform should be built technically. I can spoof it. I can't actually spoof it to an engineer. Thankfully, we have a lot of people who are really good at that stuff, so I don't need to. But it's something I'd love to know probably more about. And then the other thing is I probably jump in on things. Probably need to be held back occasionally to think about it a little bit more before I press go.
Talk to me about mistakes you might have made in the past. Is there anything you can think of with Wayflyer or even beforehand where you know you've made a big mistake and maybe what you learned from it?
There was one time in particular, which I won't go into specifics of, but I had a chance to buy a like big portfolio of assets that I knew a lot about, and I knew I was buying very, very cheaply compared to what it was going to be worth. And it took me too long to kind of figure out that I could do it myself, and probably didn't have the tenacity to go for it. And I regret that, and have, because I'd probably be relaxing on a beach somewhere if I'd done that. And there's been a few times initially when I was younger where I definitely had kind of an opportunity come up and didn't go for it. And I've had friends now that I try and push to take up opportunities, and annoys me when they don't. When you're young, you've no responsibilities in terms of family to take care of. Why not go for it? You know, why not take up this random job working in a startup somewhere that's probably not going to work out? Because who cares? Like, in 6 months' time, you can go get a job somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think being willing to take those risks early before you do have responsibilities down the road is important, or something I've learned off the back of that, and something I try to tell other people to do, mm-hmm. and really push them on. Doesn't always work, but
well, it's clearly had a big impact just even from being in San Francisco and seeing how people think there and just really having a go. Like, in general, that has had an impact, and it's been a learning for you early on as well, you'd have to say.
Absolutely. It's by far the best thing that ever happened to me was getting that exposure to San Francisco, to mm-hmm. venture, to all of these people thinking big and I'm really going for it. And like, some of them really young. I mean, Shane Curran in Evervault, I don't know if you know Shane. Shane's an Irish guy, he started a business. He's raised like 20 million from some of the biggest firms out in San Francisco. And he is 18 years, he was in sixth year in school when he started the business, and I've met him and we were talking about it, and I'm like, this guy is just going for it. Like, he's just going for it, persistently, aggressively going for it. This is not like, oh, I'll build a nice business here. He's like, I'm building a $100 billion business here. Mm-hmm. And it's cool meeting that and seeing people who are that young or that ambitious and being able to kind of follow suit.
Who do you rely on for business advice?
Good question. Bit of a cliche, but my dad.
Yeah.
I'll ring my dad most days with a question on something. I'd say I ring him every day nearly with a question on something. And sometimes I know the answer already, and I'm kind of ringing him for confirmation that I'm thinking the same way. But yeah, he's the person I rely on most for business advice.
What's his background?
He was an accountant originally. He got into sports psychology, worked with some really cool sports people, and now he works in business psychology, let's call it, and with people and teams and stuff. He works with the senior teams in places like Nike and a whole bunch of other big companies like that. So he's seen a lot, which is good. Mm-hmm. So he always has an answer, and he's definitely the person I rely on the most for that.
Do you think that advice is more personal advice, trying to get out of your own way, based on the fact that he's in psychology and coaching and that kind of thing? Or is it technical advice or strategic advice from a business point of view?
It's probably strategic most of the time. Mm-hmm. Originally, when I first started off doing stuff, it was like technical stuff, mm-hmm. where it was like, I've never actually built out a cash flow statement and presented it to a board. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I was just out PwC. So stuff like that was technical. Now it's strategic. Mm-hmm. And definitely I ring him when I have a difficult situation with a person, and that might be, we need to fire someone, or we have a disgruntled customer, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. It's ringing him and asking him, what do I say and how do I approach kind of getting to a neutrality with them where we're both happy with the outcome? Mm-hmm. I do that all the time. I literally, to the point I'm like, what do I say? It's like, I think when you go to a funeral when you're younger and you've no idea what to say, mm-hmm. and you're like, what do I, give me the exact words, because I'm so awkward here and I don't know what to do. And that's what I do. Like, mm-hmm. this is going to be an awkward situation for everyone involved.
Yeah.
If you can just give me the like words exactly to say, mm-hmm. I know what to say. I'm going in there with it, and we can go in, get it done, and get out.
Yeah, because there are difficult situations.
There's loads, loads of them, man, yeah. loads of them.
So you're a keen golfer.
Yeah, yeah.
How was that? When did that start? When did you start playing golf? How did you kind of develop over the years?
Yeah, so I played, my dad's family are big golfers. My uncle Arthur would have played Walker Cup and played in British Opens and US Opens and a whole bunch of things. Dad's a scratch golfer. And so I think I played my first 3 holes of golf when I was 2. Do you know? It was literally born with a club. One of my dad's friends cut down an old 7-iron for me. And I had that when I was 2-3 years old and used it. Played growing up, played loads of sports. I'm really competitive, like incredibly competitive. Not aggressively so, quietly competitive, but mm-hmm. really competitive. And golf ended up being the thing I was best at of all the sports. And I played through university, played after university, have played no golf in the last 18 months, probably played 8 rounds of golf. Mm-hmm. I look forward to getting back to it, to be honest with you, at some stage. Mm-hmm. I definitely miss it. But it's been really helpful. And I think we talked about this earlier at one point, and it's great for connections, the golfing world. Mm-hmm. So it is. It definitely helped us early doors. Let's call it with investors and stuff like that, with connections into businesses that can help you. But I think more than that, what it's helped me is that competitiveness and maybe ambition that at a top level in sport kind of drives into you. Mm-hmm. It moves across to everything else. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell has a book, Outliers, mm-hmm. if I'm saying that correctly, and they have this thing, the 10,000 hour rule. And I remember reading that I must have been in school, and I'm of the firm belief that, like, if I work harder than you, I'm going to be better than you. Mm-hmm. And that was always how I approached sport. I mean, I used to love getting up before school and going out and playing 18 holes of golf. Going, no one else is awake right now. Like, that's my, we're being up late at night studying 2 o'clock in the morning. Going, no one else is doing this right now. Mm-hmm. And it's that that probably drives into everything else that I do. If I just work harder than you, I'm going to beat you. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not there yet, but I'm going to beat you in the long run. That kind of transcends into maybe a bit of a workaholic nature, which I don't know if that's the best thing. I will probably learn in later life if that was a good idea or a bad idea. It's something I'm maybe addicted to a certain extent. I couldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't know how to work 3 days a week, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Or something like that.
Do you think that kind of competitive edge has been a positive force in general?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I think everyone's pretty competitive. Some people are more aggressively competitive than others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it ends up kind of filtering through to ambition. Sports, like the foundation of competition, let's call it. And so when you end up being in sport early, I'm sure you well know it from all the sports you've played.
And playing at a very low level indeed.
but it's just trying to be better, working hard at something, always trying to improve at it, that follows through and filters through into everything else you end up doing.
Absolutely.
You know, I think if you got guys like Michael Phelps, who used to spend every single day in the pool, I think he spent every day between one of the Olympics to the other, because he said that when you get out of the pool, even for a day, you lose a bit of speed because mm-hmm. your skin just, there's something happens. Mm-hmm. So he was like, I'm not missing one day in the pool for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
And like, I've no doubt no matter what he did, he'd be like that mm-hmm. and he'd be successful because of it.
Yeah, I haven't read this book, but Donald Trump has a book called How to Get Rich, and there's a full chapter on it. And I think it's called Play Golf. And it's just all about, hey, if you want to be a success in business, you should play golf.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're on the right side of
yeah.
Talk to me about the future of e-commerce. And like, based on where Wayflyer is, you're kind of, you know, you're part software company, part financial company, part marketing company. Talk to me about how e-commerce has changed, how business has changed over the last few years, and how Wayflyer is positioned to kind of take advantage of that over the next while.
Sure. So I think, first off, we've just gotten incredibly lucky with timing. I think when we started this, we were already on a bit of a wave, because this idea of revenue-based financing that we got into is becoming a big thing, mm-hmm. and we're early in it. So I said to Aiden a few times, we're on a wave, so even if we kind of do a shit job of it, it's going to carry us, mm-hmm. you know, forward. And that's a nice position to be in. I think COVID hit, and unlike any other business, was the best thing to ever happen, because e-commerce all of a sudden was front and center. All of the companies we were working with were doing better mm-hmm. than they'd ever done before. The cost of advertising on online platforms halved, and that was driven by big companies like your Red Bulls, your Aer Lingus, your Ryanair's. They stopped advertising on platforms, and Amazon stopped advertising on Google, because they focused just on necessary goods. And that meant that the competition had dropped, more people were on their phones, more people were on their laptops, and you had this weird dynamic of supply and demand that meant that the cost of getting someone to click through to your website halved. And that happened in the space of 2 weeks, mm-hmm. between March 9th and March 23rd. Mm-hmm. And so our advice to every company we work with all of a sudden was, keep your foot on the gas. Don't stop spending. Whatever you do, don't stop spending. Actually, spend more, because you're getting double the return on ad spend you were getting before, because mm-hmm. the cost has dropped. And so that was great for us. We were lucky. No one saw that coming, and we were very, very lucky with that. I think the future of e-commerce it's gotten a big boost. Okay, I think these aren't my words, but like, e-commerce was increasing year on year, and this has just been an accelerant for it. Mm-hmm. It's like jumped us probably 3-4 years into the future straight away. I think as we get down to one day delivery and everything Amazon's doing in this world for online, it's just going to keep increasing the amount of spend we have online. I mean, this Q4 this year, even if consumer spend is down, surely such a larger portion is going to be online compared to in shops. And so e-commerce is going to do well out of it, you know? And so I think we're lucky. We're in a good sector for that. And I hope we can just, I hope we can help companies to take advantage of it, to be honest with you.
It's interesting to me that Wayflyer might not have been able to exist, you know, 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago. They just wouldn't have been able to plug in the metrics as you can now.
Yeah, we wouldn't have been able to pull out any of the data from the platforms. APIs weren't there. They certainly, if they were there, they definitely weren't smooth like they are today. We could never do what we do today. Our whole process is how can we make this as smooth as possible for the customer and as quick as possible. So for a customer, when they come to us, they are clicking and connecting four systems. It's a Gmail sign in, they hit allow access, and we pull down all of that data. It takes about 20 minutes to pull down. We generate a dashboard to show them their campaigns and give them budget optimization straight off the bat on how they should change the budgets on those campaigns. And we generate offers for them, and they have them in an hour. And if they accept them, we're going to connect into their bank account. You've Plaid and all these systems where you're able to connect directly into their bank account. Again, they don't need to do anything by Gmail sign in and hit allow. And so from a customer's experience point of view, it's like, I'm not going to waste any of my time filling out an application form here. I'm literally going to tell you my shop name, and I'm going to connect these data sources, and you're going to do everything else. And that speed is so important for our customers, especially in e-commerce, where you've got a founder doing everything, you know, and a small, small team. And they just don't have time to think about going through an application for a loan. And that's a big advantage. And I think that's the lending part. And we really are trying to turn that lending model on its head, where typically with lenders, they give you money and they're the last people you go to when things are going wrong. You know, the lender hears from you at the end when you've just missed all these repayments and everything is a disaster. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what we're trying to do is I'm pulling in your performance every day. And if anything drops off, I'm going to try and do everything I can to help improve that performance. And actually, I'm probably the best person to do it because I've got 3,000 companies on my platform. I know exactly what the people who are performing are doing, mm-hmm. you know, what types of campaigns they're running and what types of campaigns are working. And actually, when you ask me, why is my cost of acquiring a customer gone up this week? I can say everyone's has, because there's just more people in the platforms. Mm-hmm. Or why has it gone down this week? It's specific to you and that new creative that you put out there, you know. That ability to benchmark and give them that advice from a view of having everyone's numbers is very, very important, you know.
What's the goal or the vision for Wayflyer in the next few years? Where do you want to get us to?
We had a session, a values session recently in the company and trying to figure out what our company's values are. And I like to think that as long as we can help our customers grow and be successful as fast as they can, mm-hmm. We're doing good things. And what that means for us is helping them to get better inventory terms mm-hmm. with their suppliers. That's everything to helping them figure out how much stock they actually need to order. You know, based on our forecasts, it's so common that companies come to us and they're out of stock in their top three products. And you're going, if you're out of stock in your top three products, you've just lost X amount of sales, mm-hmm. you know? So don't fall into that pitfall. And everything to, can I automate and manage your marketing? Okay? We aren't sure if we can do that fully yet, but we're trying to figure it out. And there's definitely going to be a level where we can get to where we can really, really help you on that point and hopefully do it on an automatic basis. But that'll take a while.
You look after your customers,
yeah.
And your upside look after itself.
Exactly. Like we want to have, if people want to get into retail and their e-commerce companies, we'd love to have a building in New York that they can set up pop-up shops in to see if it works, you know. Anything to help those customers grow and figure out their businesses is good for us, you know, and we'll figure out the other piece of how we monetize it, how we make money off it as we go. It's really, if we can do that for customers, we're going to be in a really nice position, and e-commerce is just such a big market that it's going to be worthwhile.
I think that's a good point to finish up on. Jack Pierce, thank you very much.
Connor, thanks for having me. It's been great.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.